Welcome back to the Kidney Compass, a podcast focused on all things related to clinical trials in nephrology. I'm Shika Wadwani, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Brendan Nguyen. We have been so appreciative of everyone's support for our podcast launch at ASN Kidney Week 2024 in San Diego. While we were there, we were fortunate enough to interview three international superstar clinical trialists in nephrology and talk to them about our late-breaking presentations. So, Brendan, I would love to know, I definitely had the post-ASN blues. How have things been for you since ASN? What kind of left you most energized and maybe what surprised you?
Thanks, Shika. It was good to see you in person and catch up with everyone in San Diego. I thought it was a great meeting, a lot of really promising therapeutic progress across a range of areas, not least glomerular diseases, you know, really great developments in IgA nephropathy with APRIL-BAFF inhibitors. We had progress with semaglutide in non-diabetic kidney disease, but also really interesting methodological progress in rarer kidney diseases like FSGS. And there was a really great session on the Parasol Initiative, which is working to accelerate drug development and therapeutic progress in FSGS, an incredibly important area of nephrology. And that was, I think, a really great session and one that I thought coming home was one that we should highlight through Kidney Compass.
Yes, I completely agree with you. It's been really exciting to be a part of and see, you know, this global effort that, as we'll hear about today, really only started a year ago. And it's an incredible project that brought together, you know, sponsors including NephCure, the International Society of Glomerular Disease, the KHI or the Kidney Health Initiative, the National Kidney Foundation, and the U.S. Federal Drug Administration. So, I am really excited that we get to talk about Parasol today, and we are so thrilled to have Dr. Laura Mariani, who's one of the co-chairs of the Parasol Project, here as one of our guests, as well as Dr. Danny Gale, who's been heavily involved in this project. So welcome.
Thanks so much for having us.
Great to be here.
So for our listeners, Dr. Mariani is from the University of Michigan and Professor Gale is from UCL in London. And so, Laura, why don't you, and Danny, why don't you introduce yourselves to our listeners and tell them a little bit about yourselves and your background, particularly with respect to this project?
Sure. So I'm Laura Mariani. I'm a nephrologist, like you said, of the University of Michigan. I take care of adult patients and have a clinical interest in glomerular disease. So all things glomerular, but I think I have this special place in my heart for FSGS because it's just such a challenging disease to take care of. It's so heterogeneous, you know, affecting people kind of in the prime of their life often. And so I've always, I think, really felt like I couldn't give the answers I wanted to those patients in particular. So clinically, that's what I love to do, but I have the kind of typical academic job. So I spend a lot of my time doing research. I also teach in the medical school. And what sort of got me linked into the Parasol group was I run a big NIH-funded study called CureGN, where we have followed patients now. We've been enrolling patients for 10 years that have minimal change, FSGS, membranous, and IgA. And so these observational cohorts, I think, were really the anchor to the Parasol Project. So that's sort of how I got involved.
Great. And I'm Danny Gale. I'm also an adult nephrologist from London. I look after patients, particularly those with inherited and rare kidney disorders. And I spend a lot of my time doing research into genetics and genomics. But one of the my main activities is I direct the RADAR registry, which was set up in the UK in 2010 and collects data from now over 35,000 people from over 100 sites across the country. And more recently, we've begun analyzing the data and we're beginning to realize just how powerful observational data can be to advance understanding of and hopefully transform treatments for people with rare kidney disease.
That's amazing, Danny. You know, the radar registry has been such a beacon and shining light in nephrology, particularly for rare diseases, and super thankful to everything you've done in this space, and Laura as well with CureG, and how that's really coalesced a coalition of people around improving glomerular diseases. We are part of our interest at Kidney Compass is sharing, particularly with early career people, how you got started in this. You know, how did you get in? How did you start your journey as an academic nephrologist through CureGN? How did you get involved in the radar registry? And I'm sure many people be interested, particularly early career people, in how you kind of translated and your interest and passion into action. Laura, perhaps maybe you could start with your story.
Yeah. So, okay. So full disclosure, I went to medical school thinking I was going to be a general pediatrician. And now here I am, you can see. So career paths change. I'll just say that best laid plans go by the wayside. So, but to answer your question, I would say, I think the best decision I made was actually to get formal research training. So as part of my fellowship, I got a master's in clinical epi. That really gave me the skill set, I think, to be able to analyze data, ask good questions, and then relatedly write grants. You know what I mean? So so actually the NIH in the US puts out funding announcements periodically. I was, you know, in some ways just lucky to be in the right place at the right time, where Michigan and some other organizations collectively applied to be the data coordinating center for CureGN. And but as an early career person, I think a lot of times what early career people have is just time to do all the grunt work. So I remember one of the first things I did for Cure and Neptune was like clean all the medication data. And then you became the person who like knew the data better than anyone else. And so sometimes those like thankless jobs turn out to like, you know, give you kind of ownership over something. And then, you know, here I am all these years later running this study.
Yeah, it's incredible, Laura. I think you and I met initially. We were introduced because of CureGN and all of the work that was being done. And I was starting out at my glomerular disease clinic and wanted to get involved in something bigger than my little silo. And so, you know, kudos to you for everything you've done in CureGN and Neptune, and now the amount of data that's out there and all of the studies that are coming from that is really remarkable and, you know, moving the field forward. So similarly, I think, Danny, you're doing things across the pond that, as Brendan mentioned, have really transformed our understanding of glomerular diseases and other rare kidney diseases. Can you tell us a little bit about how you ended up where you are?
Yeah, I mean, like Laura, it's sort of a series of accidents that leads to you know, wherever anyone ends up. But I guess my career path was I was starting research as a fellow, looking at sort of genetic and genomic analyses in ultra rare, undescribed familial conditions. And through that, I developed some kind of quantitative genetics expertise, applying in those days it was genome wide linkage studies, but then more recently genomic sequencing approaches. And that sort of gave me insight into the challenges around rare kidney diseases, but also it came along with a set of kind of statistical skills and exposures that really lent itself to conducting analyses of what were initially quite small but rapidly growing cohorts of patients with rare diseases. What I would say is that certainly in the UK, the limiting factor is actually number of clinicians with an interest in rare diseases. And we have in our radar registry, we have more diseases than we've got people who have expertise in them. So you'll see the same people desperately trying to advance research in numerous different diseases. So I think for early career and aspiring clinical academics interested in rare diseases, there's a lot we don't know and a lot of work that still needs to be done. And hopefully with the advances in treatments that are becoming, that are being developed, a lot of opportunities to do really good clinical studies.
That's great. I mean, there are so many good lessons here that I want to unpack further. We need to do another episode on this, Shikha. So So I think we should just get straight into this and find out a little bit about, or Danny, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the RADAR registry and the insights that you've learned and obtained about FSGS, the natural history and prognosis. And we know how heterogeneous it is, but maybe you could tell us a little bit about the experience from RADAR.
Yeah, I mean, RADAR's, I mean, as I think most people know, but it's real world data, and it collects data from people who give consent for their past, present, and future clinical record to be stored and analyzed for research purposes, which means that when people get recruited, whether they have got a kidney transplant or they're on dialysis or they're at any stage of their disease, we can then build up a longitudinal view of what happens to them over time. And because some of our patients were diagnosed as far back as the 1970s, it means that with nationwide coverage, we've got a view of disease course that really extends the whole life of many of our patients. And this allows us to perform kind of rigorous analyses that reveal what many nephrologists will have known from their clinical experience, but it will have taken many decades of clinical experience to actually ascertain that knowledge from an individual patient. So, for instance, patients with IgA nephropathy who don't have that much proteinuria, actually some of them do end up with very poor kidney function or even kidney failure. And it's being able to look at scale at whole populations of patients that and across the very long-term follow-up that's allowed us to really start get some traction on these relationships between clinical parameters early in the disease and what happens to people later on in the disease. One of the key findings that we published earlier this year was just how bad many of these rare kidney diseases are in terms of renal survival and risk of kidney failure. And it's something that nephrologists probably know intuitively, but in the wider medical community, I don't think has been as widely recognized as perhaps it might have been, which is that rare kidney diseases actually make a massive contribution to the overall burden of kidney failure. And I think those sorts of insights that you can only really get from large cohorts of patients being very valuable. And of course, this is not something that one person or one team can do. And it's really a testament to the UK Kidney Association and various funders, including the Medical Research Council and Kidney Research UK and others, who came together over a very long period of time to establish the community. We've got over 250 investigators at various sites to contribute each small numbers of patients, but to build up this emerging picture of the burden of these rare kidney diseases.
There's so many things I want to touch on here just with that. But I think, you know, Danny, one of the things that IgA nephropathy is having its moment. And I know Laura will joke about kind of feeling like, when is FSGS going to be there? And I think we're getting closer and closer. But part of why I think IgA is having that moment is these realizations from the observational data that RADAR and others have shown us, and really putting it into something tangible, like looking at, you know, GFR loss over a patient's lifetime. And then the KHI project, which really, I think, the accelerated approval pathway that has lent itself to having much more interest from sponsors going into the drug development space for IgA nephropathy has, of course, been instrumental. And now kind of getting the combination of the data, getting the new drugs, we're seeing more positive trials than we've ever seen before, and multiple simultaneous publications at ASN. So I guess, you know, kind of transitioning to you, Laura, why has FSGS in particular been so difficult for us as a field? You know, I think we know that it's a heterogeneous disease, but, you know, can you talk a little bit about what those specific difficulties are with this rare kidney disease compared to others, and maybe how that led to the conception of the Parasol project?
Yeah. I mean, I think obviously, you know, rare kidney disease has a few strikes against it when it comes to designing clinical trials, right? So, you know, by necessity, if it's rare, you're going to need many, many sites. If you were going to really study the disease outcomes we care about, you'd study kidney failure. But obviously, you can't study a small number of patients for decades to know if a new therapy works. So, you know, I think it has always needed, you know, a community of sites that can perform clinical trials, but then it really needs the right outcome. You know, you need an outcome that you can assess in a short period of time. And I think that's especially challenging when the underlying biology is heterogeneous. You know, as soon as you put a group of people into a trial where the biology is very, is, you know, has some heterogeneity, you know, that's noise you're introducing. And you're, you know, the more noise you introduce in that sort of diagnosis, the less you're going to be able to see an effect size that's different between the treated and the untreated group. And I think, you know, IgA kind of gets this pass now on it being biologically homogeneous, but I think any nephrologist who has met an IgA patient knows that that's probably not true either, right? Like, we have patients that, you know, have that classic syn-pharyngitic presentation, and then those other patients that have that, like, grinding low-level proteinuria. Then IgA vasculitis is, I don't, who knows even what, if that's the same thing. So, like, you know, I think the other GNs have this problem too. But for FSGS, we know this is true, right? We know there's some that have that phenotype of, like, explosive onset nephrotic syndrome. Certainly the genetic causes of FSGS are there. The quote-unquote secondary, which is a term I really dislike because I just don't know. I just don't know what that is biologically. So in all of those, we kind of put together. So I think, you know, it has the usual challenges of kidney disease plus rare disease plus underlying biologic heterogeneity plus having both kids and adults. I mean, it's really, it's a high bar to jump over for an FSGS trial. But for Parasol, the, you know, the thing we were trying to tackle of all of those strikes is the outcome. And I think probably most people know that the reason Parasol got launched was actually not this ASN, but the prior ASN, where the data came out looking at sparsentan in FSGS. And it came out the same time of sparsentan and IgA. And in both studies, proteinuria dropped, but in the IgA trial, they could show an association with GFR, and FSGS they couldn't. And so it raised this question of, you know, why was the link between proteinuria and GFR? Why did it not hang together? And there's probably lots of explanations for that. You know, is it that proteinuria is not a good outcome for FSGS? Is it a problem that GFR is not a good outcome for FSGS? You know, really, like, why didn't this hang together in the way that kind of clinically we all use that, right? Like, we, you know, we use our short-term proteinuria data in this population. So that was the problem. And now if there's, you know, if it's unclear what the right thing to measure is in a feasible trial window, then that's where we went back and said, okay, we need a data, and we need a lot of data. And because there's so much heterogeneity, we need data sets from all over the place, because there's no way that one data set is going to answer this question of what's the association between change in proteinuria, change in GFR, and kidney failure in this population.
So that's really useful contextual information, Laura. It was Duplex that really set this conversation off. And so how did this all happen? What was the backstory to how you formed this coalition? ISGD were involved, other partners are involved. How did you bring together this group? And what was that process like of getting data on FSGS patients from a range of global cohorts together to the Data Coordinating Center in Michigan?
Yeah, it was actually, this is my favorite part of the Parasol story, of just like the out and out generosity of like the worldwide nephrology community. You know, I think we just don't always think about kind of the ability to work together and kind of overcome all the barriers that it is to share data across all the different countries that have it. But essentially what happened is, you know, NephCure, the patient advocacy organization, I mean, they really view their mission is to try to cure that disease among many protein spilling diseases. And so they saw this obviously as an alarm for if there is no regulatory path for approval for FSGS trials, there will be no innovation in that space. And so they I think learning from the Kidney Health Initiative projects about how powerful it is to bring together organizations. I actually have to give the credit to NephCure and International Society of Glomerular Disease saying, okay, where can we start and who can we pull together? And so they brought in the National Kidney Foundation, given their prior projects where they had sponsored looking at albuminuria and GFR slope for approval in just CKD trials in general. And then, of course, the Kidney Health Initiative had done similar work in the past. So those were the organizations that came together. I got involved, like I said, I think largely just because we had this CureGN data set sitting there where we had, you know, over 600 patients with FSGS, both children and adults. We had long-term prospective data collection. So it was a good anchor, but it was by no means everything we needed. And so it really was, hey, I heard UNC has data. And we called up UNC colleagues and said, hey, would you be willing to share your data? And they said, oh, yeah, that's totally doable. Here's what we have. Here's what we don't have. They said, oh, yeah, and I did fellowship with so-and-so in Ottawa. I'm like, okay, hi, Ottawa. Would you be willing to share your data? I'm like, oh, yeah, great. You know what you else you should talk to? They have this great cohort in Spain. Okay, Spain. And, like, obviously, we already knew about RaDaR's data and that they'd been working in IgA. We knew they had an FSGS cohort. So it honestly dominoed. And so I spent probably 6 months meeting really phenomenal nephrologists all over the world and asking them, you know, would they be willing to contribute data? And I think a couple things made that successful. One, having our professional societies involved to really serve as honest brokers. You know what I mean? This was data we were assembling for the community. Yes, I volunteered to do all of the regulatory and contracting and all of the logistical work to make that possible. But we really, you know, tried to make it clear that this was a resource being built for the community, and to have the organizations behind us was really helpful to make that ask. We also started with a narrow ask. It wasn't like, give us all your data and we'll let you know what happens later. It was, you know, we want you to be a part of our analysis teams. We want, you know, we're going to start with this very narrow question that the FDA has asked us to answer, which is the relationship between proteinuria, GFR, and kidney failure. It's not to answer every possible question in FSGS. And then it was really lawyers, like lots of lawyers and contracting and IRBs and things like that to sort of get all this data harmonized. So that's kind of how it happened. But I have to say, I can't emphasize enough how fun it was to talk to nephrologists all over the world who were, you know, I think saw that data, were concerned about it, wanted to be a part of the solution, and were generous enough to you know, pull out data.
It's an incredible effort. And I think it's, what's even more incredible is that you were able to do it all in the timeline that you've done it in. I mean, this could have taken years and years and years, but the FSGS community doesn't have years to wait. And I think that, you know, as you mentioned, not having a path forward, we've heard from many patient panels and talking about how impactful it is just to know that there is hope coming down the pipeline. So, I think we're all extremely excited that this group of people came together to tackle this. Danny, how did you, you know, at what point did you get involved and what's that experience been like on your end?
Yeah, so my first involvement was at the ASN in 2023 in the aftermath of the duplex trial presentation. And what really struck me from the outset was, I guess, two of the things that Laura mentioned. One is that it was Josh from NephCure doing the asking. And when you're talking to patient advocacy groups, you just get such clarity on the agenda and the mission. It makes it very easy to engage as an academic, I think. And the second was the very clear and specific aims of the project. So it was, you know, we've got this problem. We want to use the data, you know, from the community to address it. And this is how we're going to do it. And, you know, it's so clear that, you know, that this is the right thing to do. And this is, you know, this stands a chance of answering the question that, you know, it was something I was very keen to be involved in right from the get-go. And actually, it works in other scientific collaborations, that if the base of the collaboration is something that's very specific, where everyone involved can clearly see what the agenda is, what the benefit is, then that's a great way to start a partnership. And of course, you know, it can then grow organically. But building those relationships and having an activity, doing something productive together is really important. So I guess that was very positive experience from the outset.
I mean, I think it was incredible to just see the excitement in the room, and how much everyone was so engaged, like at the Iceland meeting, for example. Can one of you comment on the value of having the FDA as a partner in this project and sort of, you know, the role that they've played throughout the last year and maybe longer?
Yeah, I mean, they were a really incredible partner, I have to say. So there's a formal process for co-sponsorship that we did apply for because, you know, obviously when the FDA is involved, there's kind of rules around that. But once that sponsorship agreement was signed, I mean, the analysis plan that we worked on, essentially we had just a phenomenal team of FDA biostatisticians along with us. And, you know, they the way they look at data is very different, I think, than like how we look at it clinically or how you look at it in a typical epidemiology study or how you look at it in a clinical trial. So, you know, a lot of times, you know, we publish things like risk factors for poor outcomes. That's not what the surrogate is, right? Like, and so to really hear from them how they think about data, the level of evidence they need to really make the case. And it actually made me feel good. I was like, okay, great. Like FDA is really actually watching out for the American public, making sure drugs, in fact, are safe and effective. So, you know, actually they have a high bar, but that's their job. And so actually I learned a lot from them from being a part of it. And they were, you know, I think really good about making sure they were learning from us too. Like they have to learn about kidney disease and rare kidney disease. And they were up for that challenge and explaining why, you know, FSGS is different than diabetes and different than IgA and how some of the things that even if you're using GFR and proteinuria in those settings, yes, it's true. You can have a patient spilling 25 grams of protein. They're like, that must be a data error. And I was like, no, that's not a data error. That's actually this disease. you know what I mean? So there was like, I think a two-way learning, which was really great.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely got the impression in the meetings was that they'd kind of seen it all before. They knew where they wanted the community to get to. And it was up to us to learn how to analyze the data to answer the questions in a way that would be robust enough for them to then use and action. So I felt like we as the rare disease specialist community were being tutored in these kind of regulatory considerations when interpreting clinical trials, which has been very interesting at the very least.
Oh, that's great. And so important to hear about how these collaborations and partnerships form and have worked. So I want to really drill down now into the understanding the problem and what Parasol set out to achieve. And we've kind of talked a bit around it, and many people know about it, but there'll be some listeners who don't know. So I just want to, you know, make sure that's clear and provide some context. So as Laura mentioned, you know, one of the challenges with therapeutic development in kidney disease is if you want to study kidney failure, that typically takes years, if not decades. And to identify treatment effects on that outcome, you either need very large studies or very long follow-up times. If we go back in terms of the context of where we are in 2024, initially back in 2017 and 2018, we had the NKF FDA workshop looking at 40% decline in GFR as an acceptable surrogate outcome for kidney disease progression in clinical trials. And look what 40% decline in GFR has done and has been used now in trials like Fidelio, EmpiKidney that have led to the approval of drugs like finerenone and empagliflozin for progression of kidney disease. Then fast forward a couple of years into the early 2020s and we have that great data from the CKD Epi Clinical Trials Consortium led by Leslie Inke and Hito Heerspink that showed, importantly, not just associations between GFR slope and outcomes, but that treatment effects on GFR slope predict treatment effects on clinical outcomes. And look what that has done in IgA. And now we have the PARASOL Consortium, which is again setting out to do the same thing and accelerate progress for FSGS. But Danny, maybe because you talked about this in San Diego, could you just make it really clear for our listeners the difference between a clinical outcome and a surrogate outcome, and what are the typically 2 to 3 criteria that are most important in evaluating a surrogate outcome for drug development, and which one of them is the highest bar usually?
Yeah, so the clinical outcome is what the treatment is aiming to, say, prevent or improve. So kidney failure, death. For some drugs, it might be how people feel. There are different types of clinical outcome, but typically it's something that actually in itself matters to patients. And as you just described for proteinuric rare kidney diseases, the what's amenable to a clinical trial is something that's along that predicts that, or that's being used to predict that, and that might be proteinuria, it might be change in kidney function, things that as nephrologists we might think are really important, but we think they're important because of the assumptions that we're making about how they will predict what happens to people in terms of the hard outcomes. So for a clinical trial, they can specify an endpoint, but what regulators and clinicians and patients will want to know is whether that what the implications of hitting that endpoint are for the outcome of interest. So what does reduction in proteinuria or reduction in eGFR slope, what are the implications for kidney failure events over the longer term? And of course, what you're doing is using essentially prediction of one parameter to work out what's going to happen to another one. So this is an area there's been a lot of literature and study of this going back to into the 20th century in common diseases, in cancers. There's a large literature on it, and essentially there are a number of characteristics that allow a surrogate to become established for a hard outcome. One of them is that there has to be a strong relationship between the surrogate endpoint and the outcome of interest. So you have to know in a quantitative way what the strength of that association is. And that's something that you can get from observational data. And we'll talk about that in a bit more detail with PARASOL. But related to that, and also related to the work you mentioned of Leslie Inker and Hiddos Hirsbrink, looking at treatment effects on the endpoint, on the trial endpoint, have to capture treatment effects on the outcome for that endpoint to be approvable, essentially, or usable in clinical practice. So an example might be, well, if reducing proteinuria is strongly associated with reduction in kidney failure, you might say, well, does it matter how you reduce the proteinuria? Well, of course it does, because you could reduce proteinuria by removing a kidney, say, or reducing GFR pharmacologically. And that would reduce the proteinuria. But if the treatment effect on proteinuria is not going to protect the kidney function, then clearly you can't use that on its own as a justification for approval of a drug. So you need to know that the way that the drug reduced the surrogate outcome or impacted the surrogate endpoint can allow you to predict that it will have a similar effect on the outcome of interest. And you could do that either using long-term trial data where you can correlate the two and see these strong relationships, as has been done in IgA nephropathy and unselected CKD, the very strong relationships between treatment effect on surrogates and treatment effects on outcomes. But of course, if you don't have trial data and you don't have long-term follow-up of trial data, it's very difficult to do that. And that's where the discussion moves out of the realm of PARASOL, which is establishing the parameters, to the specific discussions for each drug, because each drug has got to be able to demonstrate that the mechanism by which it achieves the trial endpoint is likely to translate to an impact on kidney failure or other hard outcome.
really interesting, Danny, and well summarized. Shika, did you want to add anything? Otherwise, I was going to ask Laura about just what she found in what they found in Parasol.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that I think the surrogate outcome or endpoint has been so important in getting us the accelerated approval pathway, for example, in IgA nephropathy. And so maybe, Laura, when you talk a little bit about starting off with Parasol, can you talk about how you considered, or I think maybe you started wanting to go down an accelerated approval pathway and looking at endpoints in that regard, but then really kind of transitioned or pivoted once you saw the data?
Yeah, you're exactly right. So I think what we started out doing was following the IgA paradigm. We thought, okay, well, maybe the best path forward is you could look at a short-term change in proteinuria and then a subsequent change in GFR, and you could see essentially how those associate with long-term kidney failure. Okay, but I think this is really important. When you design a clinical trial on that accelerated approval pathway, you actually have to power it on the confirmatory endpoint. So even if you see a difference in proteinuria early on, you still need to show that there's a difference in GFR. Okay. So essentially what we did in Parasol is we took our observational data, which we had about 1,600 patients with biopsy-proven FSGS. So I'll just leave it at that. Like, we accepted all the noise that is FSGS. So everything could come in, genetic, secondary, primary, everything. They had to have at least a gram and a half of proteinuria, and they had to have a GFR greater than 30 to make it into the cohort. And then essentially what we looked at is we looked at short-term trial intervals. So for example, you can imagine 2 years. Let's just say you're not going to ask a patient to stay in a trial longer than 2 years. So we looked at from the time their first proteinuria was above that threshold, we looked at 2 years later, we looked at the change in proteinuria during that time window, and then we had enough patients where we could look at subsequent kidney failure events. That's the outcome that we actually care about, like Danny mentioned. Okay. So essentially, I think we first started looking at GFR, and what we found, which again, it's one of these things that I think we knew as nephrologists, but it just was once you had the data in front of you and saw how bad the problem was, it really jumped out at you. And so what we found is that GFR is highly, highly variable in FSGS, especially in kids, especially in people in the normal range of GFR, especially in patients with high levels of proteinuria. So their GFR is bouncing all over the place, such that when you try to draw a slope or a change in GFR, there's so much noise that actually it's not that it doesn't predict long-term kidney failure. It does. It's just that when you try to then power a study based on the expected change in GFR and the variability, which is what you need to design to power your sample size, it comes out to like you need like 1,000 people in each arm. So it's maybe not a surprise that, like, you know, you do a normal size trial of FSGS with a few hundred patients in it, that you'll see a change in proteinuria and you cannot detect a difference in GFR. And it's not because it doesn't exist. It's because the variability is so high. But you all have seen this. You all have seen patients that go from a GFR of like 180 down to 100. And that's probably not a bad thing, right? That's probably their disease got under control. But can you imagine drawing a line between that? The slope is not going to be very predictive of their long-term kidney failure risk. And so I think we know this clinically, but that is what we saw. We saw that, you know, GFR, while it was clearly, you know, GFR is associated with kidney failure. Let me not mistake that, right? If your GFR is 20, you're at higher risk of kidney failure than if your GFR is 40, for sure. So GFR is associated with kidney failure. The problem is there's so much variability. And I think it has a lot to do with, you know, disease activity, the medications we use, all sorts of things that are creating this variability, that you just need a huge trial to be able to detect a difference between two groups. An unfeasible trial. No one is going to recruit a 2,000-person FSBS trial. So that kind of like crushed our dreams of accelerated approval pathway, because no one's going to power a trial on that confirmatory endpoint. And actually what we then found was we pivoted to maybe, you know, is there enough evidence that you could consider proteinuria on its own as a validated surrogate? So for a long time, the FDA has said publicly, this isn't me, has said that they would accept complete remission. So if you take a group of, you know, patients with significant proteinuria, you get them all the way down to normal levels of proteinuria, they would accept that. The concern had always been that maybe there's not enough FSGS patients that can hit that bar. So the question became, can we sort of liberalize that cutoff and get the same kind of level of, capture the same level of long-term protection from kidney failure? So that's where we switched to looking at proteinuria as a potentially validated surrogate. And we had enough data to actually show that. But actually, if you take people with, you know, starting out with a proteinuria of 1.5 or greater, and you get them down to really 1.75, 0.5, they have phenomenally lower risk of kidney failure later. I'm talking hazard ratios of like 0.05. I mean, just like minuscule hazard ratios. I mean, we dramatically have changed their disease course. And so, but this is observational data, right? Like there will be residual confounding here for sure. And so what we were looking for is, could we come up with a definition, a responder definition that had massive reductions in their risk of kidney failure? Not little ones. We needed big ones because we need to account for the fact that there's noise and confounding. We also wanted to know that it was robust across all of our subgroups, right? We wanted to know that if you defined it, it worked in kids, it worked in adults, it worked in people with CKD, people without CKD, worked with people with nephrotic range proteinuria, subnephrotic, because if it's truly representing a change in the underlying biology of that kidney, it should work no matter what subgroup we looked at. So to me, that was the real strength of having this big data set. And that's what we're able to do, is to find, you know, those kind of cutoffs, getting proteinuria down to, you know, 0.7, 0.75, 0.5 really kind of met all of those characteristics.
Danny, do you want to add anything to that? Speak about the biological plausibility component that's going to be a important part of this?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the first thing, we'd had the experience of looking in quite a lot of detail in IgA nephropathy and the relationships between proteinuria, GFR, and kidney failure over long term in that disease. And we saw a much more kind of, I'd say, continuous set of relationships where even low-grade proteinuria, as I mentioned before, is still quite a strong risk factor for kidney failure over the long term. But we'd also looked in other, I'd say, more relapsing remitting diseases like C3 glomerulopathy and FSGS, where, and as clinicians, you know, these diseases run a very different course clinically, where people can be, you know, they often present nephrotic, and then the disease can settle down, then it can flare again, whatever. And what we noticed in the radar data was that we saw these, we quantified the hazard ratios for kidney failure over 20 years for doubling, halving of GFR or losing percentages of GFR, but also fold reductions in proteinuria. And we'd seen in these diseases a very big difference in magnitude of the risk effects of proteinuria reduction compared to GFR slope changes. And that really struck me at that time, that you need to follow the data. I mean, that's what is telling you what's happening to the patients over the long term. And then when you think about the biology of FSGS, as Laura said, the FSGS as defined in the Parasol project was deliberately a heterogeneous group. But whatever the underlying etiological cause of the disease, the kind of essential feature is podocytopathy. So effacement of the foot processes, and then as the disease becomes visible histologically, basically dead podocytes scarring in the glomerulus. And an inevitable feature of that is proteinuria, because that is the marker of podocyte dysfunction. And then you see in the diseases or the disease states where you have diffuse podocyte foot process effacement, that there'll be high-grade proteinuria, and that's potentially reversible if you can restore podocyte function in some way. Where there's scarring in the kidney, that's probably much less amenable to treatment because we can't feasibly replace dead podocytes. So so the kind of theoretical basis of this is that if you've got an intervention that is early in the disease where you've got podocyte foot process effacement and the proteinuria being the target of treatment, and you can impact on that, then you might see very large differences in proteinuria. And because you're restoring podocyte health or you're reducing their likelihood of dying, that you might then see a benefit in terms of kidney function over the long term. So that's the sort of abstract biological plausibility. But of course, you've got to really consider each drug. Because each drug will work in a different way. Not all drugs are going to target all types of FSGS, all causes of FSGS. So it's a sort of framework to consider, to allow proteinuria to be considered, rather than a slam dunk that, yeah, every cause of proteinuria reduction is going to have this effect on kidney failure survival.
I'm glad you brought that up, Shika, because I think people outside of nephrology or people perhaps out of genes don't perhaps think about that all the time, that the proteinuria has a kind of different meaning in a podocytopathy. It's like a direct problem related to podocyte foot process effacement in a way which might not be relevant in other more common kidney diseases. So I think that lends credence to the idea that, you know, this is a powerful potential surrogate for kidney failure, specifically in FSGS. Laura, so you talked about these very strong relationships between reductions in proteinuria and clinical outcomes like kidney failure. What did the data show? Was it like a 50% reduction in proteinuria, or was it a reduction to a specific level or threshold? And if so, what kind of thresholds were most strongly associated with kidney failure?
Yeah, so there's lots of ways you can analyze proteinuria. Like, you know, you could imagine you could look at percent change, you could look at thresholds. I think one of the reasons that, at least for the start, and I will say this is, you know, I think outcomes for FSGS will change in the future. I think, you know, we need successful trials to happen such that we can learn from them and do the kind of treatment effect on surrogate and outcome work that sort of needs to be done long term. But the part of the reason that we wanted to start with an absolute cutoff was actually back to biologic plausibility. You know, you can imagine if you drop someone's proteinuria by 50% and you take someone from 4 to 2 and you take someone else from 1 to, now I'm going to mess up my math, 1 to 0.5, then you're going to call responders someone who still has a lot of proteinuria and someone who has very little proteinuria, you're going to say they're the same. And I feel like because we were trying to make this argument to the regulatory agencies that we were putting people, that we were fundamentally changing the biology of their podocytopathy, we wanted to be able to compare apples to apples. So that's why for this to first start, we were looking for thresholds. Now, I will say, the effect of change in proteinuria is so strong that almost no matter how you cut it, and probably clinically we know this too, like if you take someone from 10 to 5, yeah, you're probably doing a good thing for that patient. But that's not the same as showing like this drug is effective at preventing, you know, kidney failure in the level of evidence we needed for this first study. So that's what we started looking at. And so what we found, you know, part of the reason we liked the 0.7 cutoff is it kind of baked in that 50% decline, right? So everyone had to have a gram and a half. If you come down to 0.7, you've dropped by 50%. And some of that's just, this is observational data. Like if I ask you to run around the room and come back, your PCR is going to be a little bit different, right? So like some of this is the noise of like, this is real world measurements and, you know, we going from, you know, 1.5 to 1.4 felt like it's day of the week change, not like fundamental disease biology change. So that's some of why that particular cutoff was appealing. But we're talking hazard ratios of, I think, from if you go from 1.5 down to 0.7, the hazard ratio was 0.15. Hazard ratio of 0.15, right? So like everyone's happy about SGLT2 inhibitors, like other than, you know, 0.5. I mean, this was massive, massive association. That's good because actually getting to complete remission, the hazard ratio was 0.07. So, I mean, you can see it dramatically changes the future risk. So we were looking for kind of thresholds that were performing essentially as well as complete remission. But I think Danny's right that I think what's different about the FSGS story from IGA. One, that accelerated approval is not feasible if GFR is your outcome. And two, that probably because there's so much heterogeneity, I think there's going to be discussions about, based on the population that's enrolled, the mechanism of the drug, you know, kind of what is the right outcome measurement at the right time point for that specific drug. So I think we're probably, if I were going to guess, I would say, you know, the general idea that proteinuria can be used for full approval is probably on the table for FSGS, but that it may vary a little bit what the actual definition is trial to trial.
Great. And it's, and from memory and what you said there, Laura, is it was the 0.7, which is the threshold, the key threshold that you found a very strong relationship with?
Yeah. I mean, you know, to some extent, like, you know, it is a little bit of a continuous association once you get down. We tried to we mapped out like all these little fine cut points and tried to see, was there a natural step? I wish I could say 0.7 was magical. It wasn't. You know, probably 0.8 is just as good as 0.7. But I think there was kind of a general, you know, biologically, you know, do you feel if someone's less than 0.7 that, you know, you really have changed them, especially in people who we know have scar in their kidney, right? By definition, they have scar. You know, it bakes in that 50% decline, so it gives it some sort of face validity, and then has a roughly similar hazard ratio, I think, qualitatively compared to complete remission. So I wouldn't say it's a magic step, but, you know, it has a lot of things going for it.
Yeah, I would agree with that it's not, there's nothing special about the figure of 0.7 grams per gram. And what it does is it allows a sort of quantitative prediction, because we've got that hazard ratio. It predicts what the effect among the people who do get down to that level of on their kidney failure risk is going to be. And if you imagine a clinical trial where a drug that is therapeutically effective will shift the distribution of proteinuria readings to the left, what you'll see is more people in the drug arm who get below that 0.7 grams per gram. Now, it might be that the drug has a very minimal treatment effect and that number goes up by 20%. Okay, if the drug is a very safe drug that we've got lots of experience with, then that might be a reasonable basis on which to approve the drug. If, however, it's a new agent that targets a new biological pathway, you might want to see a much more substantial number or proportion of people meeting that endpoint in order to justify the potential hazards of that drug in that population. So really, it's just a kind of index of overall therapeutic effect. And of course, every trial is going to be different. You're going to need to look carefully at the distribution of proteinuria in the people who had the drug in the placebo group in order to really provide validation that it really means that the effect of the drug in clinical practice is going to be what you predicted. So it's a sort of marker that the therapy is going to provide benefit on a hard outcome.
So, Danny, you bring up this really good point about how, you know, with different drugs, we might be using this data differently as we're thinking about clinical trials in the FSGS space and some drugs that are going to be more general based on, you know, kidney injury pathways, some that are more focused on genetic FSGS, some that are perhaps targeting immunologic processes. How do you think that the data from the Parasol Project can be applied to these, you know, different designs as we're trying to move things forward in this disease?
Well, I think that the most important point is that it establishes that there is a route for a therapy that reduces proteinuria but doesn't necessarily cure the disease in that it doesn't completely eradicate proteinuria, that it provides a mechanism by which that could then be approved on the basis of a proteinuria reduction. In terms of which group or which etiology is targeted, I mean, if you've got a group of patients who are missing an important podocyte gene and your therapy is to put that gene back, then clearly that's going to be the group that you'll look at. But even in that group, you might not see, you won't see full restoration of the filtration barrier, because there'll be areas of the kidney that are scarred. So it allowing kind of non-complete remission proteinuria reduction as a way of approving a drug is encouraging, whatever the pathway that's being targeted. But critically, the drug has to be upstream of proteinuria. So you have to be able to make the case that the effect on proteinuria is likely to be similar to the effect on kidney failure.
No, thank you for sharing that. I think, the other thing that's always something I come back to is there are no FDA-approved drugs for FSGS, and that patient community is really holding on to something. And I know that, PROs are not ready to be prime time as clinical trial endpoints. Though shout out to the Prepare NS group that's really trying to, make a splash in that area. But I think, as we all know, buying our patients with FSGS time, whether or not, that is a few months, a few years from dialysis, kidney transplant, is really in and of itself such a goal for us. And I think being so narrow as to try to completely eradicate proteinuria, which, as you alluded to, isn't even possible for most patients, I think we forget that smaller reductions in proteinuria can have a huge impact for these patients, especially the ones that are coming in nephrotic and the pediatric patients that we all hear about that I don't think any of us necessarily treat, but we all have heard and we've, spoken to parents about that impact. So, Brendan, do you have other thoughts or questions?
No, I just wanted to ask a question about what your thoughts are about using proteinuria as a endpoint for therapeutic approval. I know, there may be people in the community who are potentially skeptical of using a surrogate outcome for proven kidney failure. But on the other hand, as you've really clearly pointed out, this is a massive area of unmet therapeutic need. We have no provable therapies. A large trial, even with GFR, large trials are infeasible. Even a GFR slope trial does not appear to be feasible. How do you respond to that kind of comment, Laura and Danny?
Yeah, obviously, I think proteinuria, do I wish that I had the magical circulating factor that we could measure and see that it goes away and know that I've really impacted, those particular patients? Sure. I know like proteinuria is kind of what we have right now. I do think the relationship between proteinuria and kidney failure in FSGS, because of all the reasons Danny said, that, fundamentally it's a podocytopathy, the signature of podocyte damage and loss is proteinuria. So to me, the link is much closer in this disease than in some of our other kidney diseases where proteinuria probably has many different causes. So I think you can make a case for this being relevant in FSGS trials in particular. But I think the most important thing in my plea to all companies and investigators designing clinical trials is please bank specimens during your trials, because what we have to do as a community is learn. So we have to be able to say, okay, we're going to successfully complete FSGS trials, and then we're going to be able to go back. And every patient that enrolls in that trial, we should have, an opportunity to study their genetics. We should have their serum and their urine banked so we can go back and find potentially even better surrogate markers for this disease. Because I think no one, everyone knows that proteinuria fundamentally is still a surrogate and it's not perfect. And so I'm sure we can improve on it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I would also say that this isn't about approving proteinuria as an endpoint for all drugs. It's got to be every drug, every therapeutic strategy. Proteinuria has got to be right for that strategy. But I think what the PARASOL data is telling us is that in this disease, it is a feasible endpoint, provided you've got the right drug or the right type of drug.
Yeah, I agree with both of your comments. And I suppose the only other thing to add, and this is a bit of a shout out for what we might do in January, is that there are also newer statistical techniques that might allow us to incorporate proteinuria with other measures of kidney function to understand the effects of a therapy. And I'm talking specifically about hierarchical composite endpoints that incorporate, in order of priority, different thresholds of kidney function loss and proteinuria. And perhaps that may be a worthwhile thing to explore in FSGS. And I know there is an NKF workshop on that in January. So we're going to be tackling on Kidney Compass everything to do with hierarchical composite endpoints. I can see Shika smiling.
Getting excited.
And so we'll talk about that later on. So just finally, Laura, perhaps where do we go from here? Where does the community go? Where does Parasol go? And when can we expect to see some of that amazing output that you presented in San Diego?
Yeah, so next step is obviously to write up the results and get them peer-reviewed and published for the whole community. So we're working hard on that. I think there's a lot of residual questions around trial design that actually the Parasol data set would potentially be helpful for. So we're reaching out to all the partners who participated to understand, you know, what's their interest in sort of future projects related to FSGS in particular. But then also, I think this has been, like I said, such a like wonderful story for nephrology that I really hope that all of this infrastructure, all of the partners that came together, I hope they're ready to tackle other questions. I'm certainly more than happy to hand over the analytic work to another team, but I sure would love to be able to reuse some of the infrastructure, the agreements that we put in place, all that stuff that kind of just lowers the bar to answer lots of good questions we have about trials and rare disease. So I'm really optimistic. I think, you know, it's been a wonderful collaboration. Like I said, I really just appreciate all the generosity of people to participate and share data and give their good ideas and poke holes in our data and all of that kind of stuff was really valuable along the way.
Danny, any final thoughts from you?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a, we've learned a lot from the work so far. And what's clear is the massive unmet need, not just in FSGS, but across rare kidney diseases. There's lots more diseases that we really don't have a handle on in terms of surrogate endpoints. So I think there's a lot more work to be done. Having the Parasol community, I mean, it's such an asset for nephrology, I think. And hopefully there'll be more opportunities to work together and get some traction on other diseases and other problems, and hopefully it'll get ever easier the more of we do it.
Go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, guys. I mean, I was just pinching myself. What a treat I get to spend my Wednesday morning with colleagues in Houston, London, and in Michigan to talk about FSGS and clinical trials. So thankful to have you both on the podcast and joining us and sharing your insights and sharing all the findings from Parasol, which are undoubtedly hugely impactful for the community, for clinicians, patients, and their caregivers. And so just wanted to say thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us and to everyone on the podcast.
Yeah, I just want to echo what Brendan said. I mean, congratulations to both of you on what you're doing for the nephrology community. I think we're so grateful that you've put the time and energy into this project. And I think it really is going to change the face of drug development. And hopefully we're going to start seeing some new trials for FSGS and hopefully successful trials. So on behalf of Kidney Compass, also just want to thank everyone for joining us. We're looking forward to continuing to bring you exciting insights into clinical trials in the new year. And if you haven't had a chance to yet check out our other episodes, we are available on hcplive.com as well as on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. So thank you all.
Thanks for having us. It was a real pleasure.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you this evening.
Bye. Thanks, everyone. Speak to you later.